The understanding that the ego is mind and that there is but one mind or intelligence begins at once to destroy the errors of mortal sense and to supply the truth of immortal sense. This understanding makes the body harmonious. It makes the nerves, bones, brain, etc. servants instead of masters. If man is governed by the law of divine mind, his body is in submission to everlasting life and truth and love. The great mistake of mortals is to suppose that man, God's image and likeness, is both matter and spirit, both good and evil. If the decision were left to the corporeal senses, evil would appear to be the master of good, and sickness to be the rule of existence, while health would seem the exception, death the inevitable, and life a paradox. Paul asked, "What concord hath Christ with Belial?" 2 Corinthians 6:15. When you say man's body is material, I say with Paul, be willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Give up your material belief of mind in matter, and have but one mind, even God, for this mind forms its own likeness. The loss of man's identity through the understanding which science confers is impossible, and the notion of such a possibility is more absurd than to conclude that individual musical tones are lost in the origin of harmony. Medical schools may inform us that the healing work of Christian Science and Paul's peculiar Christian conversion and experience, which prove mind to be scientifically distinct from matter, are indications of unnatural mental and bodily conditions, even of catalepsy and hysteria. Yet, if we turn to the scriptures, what do we read? Why, this: if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death, and henceforth know we no man after the flesh. That scientific methods are superior to others is seen by their effects. When you have once conquered a diseased condition of the body through mind, that condition never recurs, and you have won a point in science. When mentality gives rest to the body, the next toil will fatigue you less, for you are working out the problem of being in divine metaphysics, and in proportion as you understand the control which mind has over so-called matter, you will be able to demonstrate this control. The scientific and permanent remedy for fatigue is to learn the power of mind over the body, or any illusion of physical weariness, and so destroy this illusion, for matter cannot be weary and heavy laden. You say toil fatigues me. But what is this me? Is it muscle or mind? Which is tired and so speaks? Without mind, could the muscles be tired? Do the muscles talk, or do you talk for them? Matter is non-intelligent. Mortal mind does the false talking, and that which affirms weariness made that weariness. You do not say a wheel is fatigued, and yet the body is as material as the wheel. If it were not for what the human mind says of the body, like the inanimate wheel, would never be weary. The consciousness of truth rests us more than hours of repose in unconsciousness. The body is supposed to say, I am ill. The reports of sickness may form a coalition with the reports of sin and say, I am malice, lust, appetite, envy, hate. What renders both sin and sickness difficult of cure is that the human mind is the sinner, disinclined to self-correction, and believing that the body can be sick independently of mortal mind, and that the divine mind has no jurisdiction over the body. Why pray for the recovery of the sick if you are without faith in God's willingness and ability to heal them? If you do believe in God, why do you substitute drugs for the Almighty's power and employ means which lead only into material ways of obtaining help instead of turning in time of need to God, divine love, who is an ever-present help? Treat a belief in sickness as you would sin, with sudden dismissal. Resist the temptation to believe in matter as intelligent as having sensation or power. The scriptures say, "They that wait upon the Lord shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint." The meaning of that passage is not perverted by applying it literally to moments of fatigue, for the moral and physical are as one in their results. When we wake to the truth of being, all disease, pain, weakness, weariness, sorrow, sin, death will be unknown, and the mortal dream will forever cease. My method of treating fatigue applies to all bodily ailments, since mine should be and is supreme, absolute, and final. In mathematics, we do not multiply when we should subtract, and then say the product is correct. No more can we say in science that muscles give strength, that nerves give pain or pleasure, or that matter governs, and then expect that the result will be harmony. Not muscles, nerves, nor bones, but mortal mind makes the whole body sick and the whole heart faint, whereas divine mind heals. When this is understood, we shall never affirm concerning the body what we do not wish to have manifested. We shall not call the body weak, if we would have it strong, for the belief in feebleness must obtain in the human mind before it can be made manifest on the body, and the destruction of the belief will be the removal of its effects. Science includes no rule of discord, but governs harmoniously. The wish, says the poet, is ever father to the thought. We may hear a sweet melody and yet misunderstand the science that governs it. Those who are healed through metaphysical science, not comprehending the principle of the cure, may misunderstand it and impute their recovery to change of air or diet, not rendering to God the honor due to Him alone. Entire immunity from the belief in sin, suffering, and death may not be reached at this period, but we may look for an abatement of these evils, and this scientific beginning is in the right direction. We hear it said, "I exercise daily in the open air, I take cold baths, in order to overcome a predisposition to take cold, and yet I have continual colds, catarrh, and cough." Such admissions ought to open people's eyes to the inefficacy of material hygiene and induce sufferers to look in other directions for cause and cure. Instinct is better than misguided reason, as even nature declares. The violet lifts her blue eye to greet the early spring. The leaves clap their hands as nature's untired worshippers. The snowbird sings and soars amid the blasts. He has no catarrh from wet feet, and procures a summer residence with more ease than a nabob. The atmosphere of the earth, kinder than the atmosphere of mortal mind, leaves catarrh to the latter. Colds, coughs, and contagion are engendered solely by human theories. Mortal mind produces its own phenomena and then charges them to something else, like a kitten glancing into the mirror at itself and thinking it sees another kitten. A clergyman once adopted a diet of bread and water to increase his spirituality. Finding his health failing, he gave up his abstinence and advised others never to try dietetics for growth in grace. The belief that either fasting or feasting makes men better morally or physically is one of the fruits of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, concerning which God said, "Thou shalt not eat of it." Mortal mind forms all conditions of the mortal body and controls the stomach, bones, lungs, heart, blood, etc., as directly as the volition or will moves the hand. I knew a person who, when quite a child, adopted the Graham system to cure dyspepsia. For many years, he ate only bread and vegetables and drank nothing but water. His dyspepsia increasing, he decided that his diet should be more rigid, and thereafter he partook of but one meal in 24 hours, this meal consisting of only a thin slice of bread without water. His physician also recommended that he should not wet his parched throat until 3 hours after eating. He passed many weary years in hunger and weakness, almost in starvation, and finally made up his mind to die, having exhausted the skill of the doctors, who kindly informed him that death was indeed his only alternative. At this point, Christian Science saved him, and he is now in perfect health without a vestige of the old complaint. He learned that suffering and disease were the self-imposed beliefs of mortals and not the facts of being, that God never decreed disease, never ordained a law that fasting should be a means of health. Hence, semi-starvation is not acceptable to wisdom, and it is equally far from science, in which being is sustained by God, mind. These truths, opening his eyes, relieved his stomach, and he ate without suffering, giving God thanks. But he never enjoyed his food as he had imagined he would when still the slave of matter. He thought of the flesh pots of Egypt, feeling childhood's hunger and undiscipline by self-denial and divine science. This newborn understanding that neither food nor the stomach, without the consent of mortal mind, can make one suffer, brings with it another lesson. That gluttony is a sensual illusion, and that this phantasm of mortal mind disappears as we better apprehend our spiritual existence and ascend the ladder of life. This person learned that food affects the body only as mortal mind has its material methods of working, one of which is to believe that proper food supplies nutriment and strength to the human system. He learned also that mortal mind makes a mortal body, whereas truth regenerates this fleshly mind and feeds thought with the bread of life. Food had less power to help or to hurt him after he had availed himself of the fact that mind governs man, and he also had less faith in the so-called pleasures and pains of matter. Taking less thought about what he should eat or drink, consulting the stomach less about the economy of living and God more, he recovered strength and flesh rapidly. For many years, he had been kept alive, as was believed, only by the strictest adherence to hygiene and drugs, and yet he continued ill all the while. Now he dropped drugs and material hygiene and was well. He learned that a dyspeptic was very far from being the image and likeness of God, far from having dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle, if eating a bit of animal flesh could overpower him. He finally concluded that God never made a dyspeptic, while fear, hygiene, physiology, and physics had made him one contrary to his commands. In seeking a cure for dyspepsia, consult matter not at all, and eat what is set before you, asking no question for conscience' sake. We must destroy the false belief that life and intelligence are in matter, and plant ourselves upon what is pure and perfect. Paul said, "Walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh." Sooner or later, we shall learn that the fetters of man's finite capacity are forged by the illusion that he lives in body instead of in soul, in matter instead of in spirit. Matter does not express spirit. God is infinite, omnipresent spirit. If spirit is all and is everywhere, what and where is matter? Remember that truth is greater than error, and we cannot put the greater into the less. Soul is spirit, and spirit is greater than body. If spirit were once within the body, spirit would be finite, and therefore could not be spirit. The question, "What is truth?" convulses the world. Many are ready to meet this inquiry with the assurance which comes of understanding, but more are blinded by their old illusions and try to give it pause. If the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. The efforts of error to answer this question by some ology are vain. Spiritual rationality and free thought accompany approaching science and cannot be put down. They will emancipate humanity and supplant unscientific means and so-called laws. Peals that should startle the slumbering thought from its erroneous dream are partially unheeded, but the last trump has not sounded, or this would not be so. Marvels, calamities, and sin will much more abound as truth urges upon mortals its resisted claims. But the awful daring of sin destroys sin and foreshadows the triumph of truth. God will overturn until he come whose right it is. Longevity is increasing and the power of sin diminishing, for the world feels the alterative effect of truth through every pore. As the crude footprints of the past disappear from the dissolving path of the present, we shall better understand the science which governs these changes and shall plant our feet on firmer ground. Every sensuous pleasure or pain is self-destroyed through suffering. There should be painless progress, attended by life and peace, instead of discord and death. In the record of 19 centuries, there are sects many, but not enough Christianity. Centuries ago, religionists were ready to hail an anthropomorphic God and array his vicegerent with pomp and splendor. But this was not the manner of truth's appearing. Of old, the cross was truth's central sign, and it is today. The modern lash is less material than the Roman scourge, but it is equally as cutting. Cold disdain, stubborn resistance, opposition from church, state laws, and the press are still the harbingers of truth's full-orbed appearing. A higher and more practical Christianity, demonstrating justice and meeting the needs of mortals in sickness and in health, stands at the door of this age, knocking for admission. Will you open or close the door upon this angel visitant, who cometh in the quiet of meekness, as he came of old to the patriarch at noonday? Truth brings the elements of liberty. On its banner is the soul-inspired motto, "Slavery is abolished." The power of God brings deliverance to the captive. No power can withstand divine love. What is this supposed power which opposes itself to God? Whence cometh it? What is it that binds man with iron shackles to sin, sickness, and death? Whatever enslaves man is opposed to the divine government. Truth makes man free. You may know when first truth leads by the fewness and faithfulness of its followers. Thus it is that the march of time bears onward freedom's banner. The powers of this world will fight and will command their sentinels not to let truth pass the guard until it subscribes to their systems. But science, heeding not the pointed bayonet, marches on. There is always some tumult, but there is a rallying to truth's standard. The history of our country, like all history, illustrates the might of mind and shows human power to be proportionate to its embodiment of right thinking. A few immortal sentences, breathing the omnipotence of divine justice, have been potent to break despotic fetters and abolish the whipping post and slave market. But oppression neither went down in blood, nor did the breath of freedom come from the cannon's mouth. Love is the liberator. Legally, to abolish unpaid servitude in the United States was hard, but the abolition of mental slavery is a more difficult task. The despotic tendencies, inherent in mortal mind and always germinating in new forms of tyranny, must be rooted out through the action of the divine mind. Men and women of all climes and races are still in bondage to material sense, ignorant how to obtain their freedom. The rights of man were vindicated in a single section and on the lowest plane of human life when African slavery was abolished in our land. That was only prophetic of further steps towards the banishment of a worldwide slavery found on higher planes of existence and under more subtle and depraving forms. The voice of God in behalf of the African slave was still echoing in our land when the voice of the herald of this new crusade sounded the keynote of universal freedom, asking a fuller acknowledgement of the rights of man as a son of God, demanding that the fetters of sin, sickness, and death be stricken from the human mind, and that its freedom be won, not through human warfare, not with bayonet and blood, but through Christ's divine science. God has built a higher platform of human rights, and He has built it on diviner claims. These claims are not made through code or creed, but in demonstration of on earth peace, goodwill toward men. Human codes, scholastic theology, material medicine, and hygiene fetter faith and spiritual understanding. Divine science rends asunder these fetters, and man's birthright of soul allegiance to his Maker asserts itself. I saw before me the sick, wearing out years of servitude to an unreal master in the belief that the body governed them rather than mind. The lame, the deaf, the dumb, the blind, the sick, the sensual, the sinner, I wished to save from the slavery of their own beliefs and from the educational systems of the pharaohs, who today, as of yore, hold the children of Israel in bondage. I saw before me the awful conflict, the Red Sea and the wilderness, but I pressed on through faith in God, trusting truth, the strong deliverer, to guide me into the land of Christian Science, where fetters fall and the rights of man are fully known and acknowledged. I saw that the law of mortal belief included all error, and that even as oppressive laws are disputed and mortals are taught their right to freedom, so the claims of the enslaving senses must be denied and superseded. The law of the divine mind must end human bondage, or mortals will continue unaware of man's inalienable rights and in subjection to hopeless slavery, because some public teachers permit an ignorance of divine power, an ignorance that is the foundation of continued bondage and of human suffering. Discerning the rights of man, we cannot fail to foresee the doom of all oppression. Slavery is not the legitimate state of man. God made man free. Paul said, "I was free born." All men should be free. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Love and truth make free, but evil and error lead into captivity. Christian Science raises the standard of liberty and cries, "Follow me. Escape from the bondage of sickness, sin, and death." Jesus marked out the way. Citizens of the world, accept the glorious liberty of the children of God and be free. This is your divine right. The illusion of material sense, not divine law, has bound you, entangled your free limbs, crippled your capacities, enfeebled your body, and defaced the tablet of your being. If God had instituted material laws to govern man, disobedience to which would have made man ill, Jesus would not have disregarded those laws by healing in direct opposition to them and in defiance of all material conditions. The transmission of disease or of certain idiosyncrasies of mortal mind would be impossible if this great fact of being were learned, namely, that nothing inharmonious can enter being, for life is God. Heredity is a prolific subject for mortal belief to pin theories upon, but if we learn that nothing is real but the right, we shall have no dangerous inheritances, and fleshly ills will disappear. The enslavement of man is not legitimate. It will cease when man enters into his heritage of freedom, his God-given dominion over the material senses. Mortals will someday assert their freedom in the name of Almighty God. Then they will control their own bodies through the understanding of divine science. Dropping their present beliefs, they will recognize harmony as a spiritual reality and discord as a material unreality. If we follow the command of our Master, take no thought for your life, we shall never depend on bodily conditions, structure, or economy, but we shall be masters of the body, dictate its terms, and form and control it with truth. There is no power apart from God. Omnipotence has all power, and to acknowledge any other power is to dishonor God. The humble Nazarene overthrew the supposition that sin, sickness, and death have power. He proved them powerless. It should have humbled the pride of the priests when they saw the demonstration of Christianity excel the influence of their dead faith and ceremonies. If mind is not the master of sin, sickness, and death, they are immortal, for it is already proved that matter has not destroyed them, but is their basis and support. We should hesitate to say that Jehovah sins or suffers, but if sin and suffering are realities of being, whence did they emanate? God made all that was made, and mind signifies God, infinity, not finity. Not far removed from infidelity is the belief which unites such opposites as sickness and health, holiness and unholiness, calls both the offspring of spirit, and at the same time admits that spirit is God, virtually declaring him good in one instance and evil in another. By universal consent, mortal belief has constituted itself a law to bind mortals to sickness, sin, and death. This customary belief is misnamed material law, and the individual who upholds it is mistaken in theory and in practice. The so-called law of mortal mind, conjectural and speculative, is made void by the law of immortal mind, and false law should be trampled underfoot. If God causes man to be sick, sickness must be good, and its opposite health must be evil, for all that he makes is good and will stand forever. If the transgression of God's law produces sickness, it is right to be sick, and we cannot, if we would, and should not, if we could, annul the decrees of wisdom. It is the transgression of a belief of mortal mind, not of a law of matter, nor of divine mind, which causes the belief of sickness. The remedy is truth, not matter, the truth that disease is unreal. If sickness is real, it belongs to immortality. If true, it is a part of truth. Would you attempt with drugs or without to destroy a quality or condition of truth? But if sickness and sin are illusions, the awakening from this mortal dream or illusion will bring us into health, holiness, and immortality. This awakening is the forever coming of Christ, the advanced appearing of truth, which casts out error and heals the sick. This is the salvation which comes through God, the divine principle love, as demonstrated by Jesus. It would be contrary to our highest ideas of God to suppose him capable of first arranging law and causation so as to bring about certain evil results, and then punishing the helpless victims of his volition for doing what they could not avoid doing. Good is not, cannot be, the author of experimental sins. God good can no more produce sickness than goodness can cause evil and health occasion disease. Does wisdom make blunders which must afterwards be rectified by man? Does a law of God produce sickness, and can man put that law under his feet by healing sickness? According to Holy Writ, the sick are never really healed by drugs, hygiene, or any material method. These merely evade the question. They are soothing syrups to put children to sleep, satisfy mortal belief, and quiet fear. We think that we are healed when a disease disappears, though it is liable to reappear. But we are never thoroughly healed until the liability to be ill is removed. So-called mortal mind, or the mind of mortals, being the remote, predisposing, and the exciting cause of all suffering, the cause of disease must be obliterated through Christ in divine science, or the so-called physical senses will get the victory. Unless an ill is rightly met and fairly overcome by truth, the ill is never conquered. If God destroys not sin, sickness, and death, they are not destroyed in the mind of mortals, but seem to this so-called mind to be immortal. What God cannot do, man need not attempt. If God heals not the sick, they are not healed, for no lesser power equals the infinite all-power, but God, truth, life, love, does heal the sick through the prayer of the righteous. If God makes sin, if good produces evil, if truth results in error, then science and Christianity are helpless. But there are no antagonistic powers nor laws, spiritual or material, creating and governing man through perpetual warfare. God is not the author of mortal discords. Therefore, we accept the conclusion that discords have only a fabulous existence, are mortal beliefs which divine truth and love destroy. To hold yourself superior to sin because God made you superior to it and governs man is true wisdom. To fear sin is to misunderstand the power of love and the divine science of being in man's relation to God. To doubt his government and distrust his omnipotent care. To hold yourself superior to sickness and death is equally wise and is in accordance with divine science. To fear them is impossible when you fully apprehend God and know that they are no part of his creation. Man, governed by his Maker, having no other mind, planted on the evangelist's statement that all things were made by him, the Word of God, and without him was not anything made that was made, can triumph over sin, sickness, and death. Many theories relative to God and man neither make man harmonious nor God lovable. The beliefs we commonly entertain about happiness and life afford no scatheless and permanent evidence of either. Security for the claims of harmonious and eternal being is found only in divine science. Scripture informs us that with God all things are possible. All good is possible to spirit, but our prevalent theories practically deny this and make healing possible only through matter. These theories must be untrue, for the Scripture is true. Christianity is not false, but religions which contradict its principle are false. In our age, Christianity is again demonstrating the power of divine principle, as it did over 1900 years ago, by healing the sick and triumphing over death. Jesus never taught that drugs, food, air, and exercise could make a man healthy, or that they could destroy human life, nor did he illustrate these errors by his practice. He referred man's harmony to mind, not to matter, and never tried to make of none effect the sentence of God, which sealed God's condemnation of sin, sickness, and death. In the sacred sanctuary of truth are voices of solemn import, but we heed them not. It is only when the so-called pleasures and pains of sense pass away in our lives that we find unquestionable signs of the burial of error and the resurrection to spiritual life.